I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There are distinctive challenges for new teachers who choose to work in big city schools. Understanding multicultural learning styles and realizing the influence that social issues can have in the classroom are just two skills that are crucial to teaching in an urban setting. Today we'll meet two beginning educators working in metro school districts on both sides of the state line. As recent graduates of UMKC's Institute for Urban Education, they're committed to 4 years of service in Kansas City area schools. We'll find out what they're looking forward to and what they're fretting about. Later, Brian McTavish shares his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Teachers all over America are starting to get those going to back to school butterflies as classes are set to begin in the next few weeks. But teaching students in rural Kansas may be different than teaching them in the inner cities of this country. A program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City is aimed at training future teachers how to handle the rigors of teaching in urban schools. We're about to find out just how challenging teaching in the big city can be. Joining us now to talk about it, our first-year teacher, Brittany Espinoza. She'll be teaching second grade at William Ellen White Elementary in Kansas City, Kansas. And Brittany, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Helen Osei will be a third-year teacher at the Academy of Integrated Arts Charter School in Kansas City, Missouri. Helen will be teaching third grade, and welcome to you too, Helen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jennifer Waddell is an associate professor of curriculum and instructional leadership in the School of Education. She's also the program director for the Institute of Urban Education. That's the program I referred to earlier. And Jennifer, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve.
I should point out that UMKC holds the license for this radio station, but KCUR remains editorially independent. Brittany, this is your first year. When do classes start, and how are you feeling about things?
I get my kids tomorrow, all 20 of them, and I'm super excited because I had some of them last year as well. I was able to move from first to second grade, so I'm really excited to see them again.
So you know some of them. That helps a little bit.
Yeah.
What are you most nervous about as you launch your first year here?
Just that I'm responsible for 20 little minds, and that's a lot of pressure, but it's something that's a privilege, and I'm excited to do it.
So when you say you had them last year, that was for what, a student teaching project? Is that what you were doing?
Yes, for all last year, from fall to May, I had them, 30 first graders, and then 10 of them are coming back to me as second graders.
You had 30 in this first class.
I did, yes. And thankfully, I was with a co-teacher who was super supportive, and I was able to learn a lot from her, and so I feel prepared to go into this next year.
How many kids are you going to have in this class you're going into?
20.
Well, that's a good number, strikes me. Yeah. So, and the thing that makes you most nervous is what?
Just that...
Again, all those minds that are right there with you?
Exactly. And so at the end of second grade, if they aren't prepared to go into third grade, there's a lot of implications that come with that. But like I said, it's a responsibility and also a privilege that I feel like I'm prepared to do.
Well, Helen, you're a two-year veteran at this point. What advice would you have for Brittany as she launches her professional teaching career?
Brittany, I'll say take it one day at a time and just make sure that every mistake is a new lesson. You could always learn from your mistakes.
You know, close your ears here, Brittany, because I wanted to ask Helen just how challenging a first year can be.
Well, for first year, I would say just getting prepared, knowing what you need in the classroom, and then trying to figure out how to meet each student at the point of their needs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge.
You always have to be thinking ahead, don't you, as to what's coming up later in the week, what's coming up tomorrow? Are you ready to teach that particular lesson? Because you're teaching what you're teaching now, but you're always having to look ahead.
Yes. The anticipation comes throughout the journey as a teacher, and it also comes from the students' ends as well. So there is no definite answer as to what it is that you're teaching right in this moment, because when you're teaching, you teach a whole student and not just a subject.
Ah, I see. The two of you teach in school districts that cater to students who, you know, don't have all the advantages of, you know, say, kids in the Shawnee Mission or the Blue Valley school districts. Why did you want to teach in the district that you're teaching in?
I chose the Kansas City, Kansas Public School District because that's where I grew up.
Ah.
I live 5 minutes from where I'm teaching at, and so I found it a unique opportunity to go back to where I came from and see students who remind me of myself and bring them up with me. So just to be like a source of encouragement for them that you can, like, go beyond the circumstances that are set before you.
Did you see yourself as a little kid thinking that maybe I'd be a teacher here in my hometown someday?
I didn't. Teaching is something that I chose later in life, but I'm very glad that I did it. But as a young child, like, I always knew that I wanted to do something where I worked with other people, just because I find, like, compassion to be something that I'm very interested in. And mm-hmm. So, yeah.
How did you get hooked up on teaching then?
I was involved with ministry in the homeless community, and I saw the implications of miseducation, so we're outside factors in their life. Several homeless people, that was something that they all had in common, to where education was something that wasn't prioritized, or they were unable to continue with their education. So I saw the downfalls of being miseducated.
You know, Jennifer, I'm just listening to Brittany thinking she's so articulate. She ought to be going for superintendent, not just teaching right now. She's ready for a superintendency somewhere. You know, she's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we've been very lucky in this too, for urban education, to have amazing candidates that come through our program. And their dedication to giving back to the community and to being fully prepared is really unmatched.
Yeah. The challenge of a first-year teacher, Jennifer, is what? So I remember my first year teaching at UMKC, and let me just say it's gotten easier as the years have passed. That first year was pretty challenging.
I think mainly to go back to some of the things that Helen was saying, it's just not knowing what to expect and getting used to the sometimes that uncomfortable not knowing what comes next, being able to build some confidence in yourself, knowing that your core belief system is also going to help students meet their potential. And just every day knowing that you have to pick up, and sometimes there will be mistakes, and learning to be okay with making mistakes as long as we're fully intended on what's best for kids.
You know, all jobs have responsibilities, but, you know, being a teacher, that's a pretty serious responsibility. Brittany already alluded to it. She has all these minds that she's going to be molding for the next 9 months. That's a heavy duty.
One of the things that we really talk about and emphasize in our program is that everything you do as a teacher is teaching a child. So as Helen mentioned, it's not just the curriculum that you're teaching, but every decision you make, every nonverbal sign that you give to a student, every comment is teaching them how to be, how to identify with themselves, whether or not to be affirmed as an individual. So it's a massive responsibility, and we're just privileged to be able to work with candidates that want to take that on full force.
Helen, I haven't gotten to you yet with this idea of why you wanted to be a teacher. What is it about teaching that drew you in so much?
Everything about teaching.
Everything?
Yes. So I'll let you know that I am originally from Ghana, West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was back in Ghana, I used to teach some of my classmates. And when I came to the United States, I was torn with so many decisions. I found out that there are children in the inner city that needed more help with mm-hmm. regards to education, and I was just interested in being a part of helping them get what they need education-wise.
How long have you been in this country?
I have been in this country for almost, I would say, 17 years.
Yeah. How did you get connected with the UMKC program?
I found it online. I actually had a mentor who is a pharmacist now. He attended UMKC School of Pharmacy. I had a conversation with him, and he was like, yeah, go for it. You'll be great. And I just went for it. He was my cheerleader, and here I am.
So teaching, based on what you've been saying, has come to you pretty naturally over the years. You're a natural teacher, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What have you enjoyed most about it as you've gone about it for 2 years here? I mean, what is it that really lights you up?
The challenges, you never know what to expect on a daily basis. One day it could be so smooth, and then the next day it's just something else. But then just learning to live with it and knowing that it's okay to be vulnerable sometimes.
Mm-hmm. When you say some days are smooth and some days things go haywire, like, give me an example. What are you talking about?
So let's say a day where everything you planned goes according to plan, and then a day where what you planned just stirs up and starts chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you get into some lessons sometimes and you're thinking, this is going really well, or you're thinking, this isn't working at all? You have a gut sense of as to how well it's going?
Yes. Sometimes you could just see the light bulb light up when you're teaching, and then there are days when you would just be wondering, okay, is this going well because of some of the facial expressions you're seeing or the kind of engagement you're getting from the students?
Yeah, you can tell a lot from the energy that's in the room sometimes tells you a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, definitely.
You know, Jennifer, again, you lead the Institute of Urban Education at UMKC. What are the types of challenges that Brittany and Helen and so many others face that may not be so common, say, in many suburban classrooms?
Well, traditionally, students in urban areas have been underserved. And so particularly, as Brittany mentioned, that students, if they're leaving second grade and they're not fully prepared for third grade, they're at a major disadvantage. And what happens often in urban schools, students are being underserved year after year. And so they really are losing opportunity for equity and access that our students in other areas have. Mm-hmm. So the number one piece is a miseducation or a lack of opportunity. So we really work with our students to try to help them understand how they don't need to have multitude of tangible resources. And as a teacher, they can still make that difference and bridge those gaps for students.
So it's what you're saying then sometimes is that, say, you're a fifth grade teacher in the city. Some of the kids in fifth grade may not be at a fifth grade level. They're still at a third grade or a fourth grade level.
Absolutely. And so there you've got the challenge of, typically we want students to obviously gain at least a year's worth of growth each academic year. Mm-hmm. Lots of times we'll term that in a year and a half to make up for any regression that may happen over the summer months. But often in urban schools, teachers are challenged with trying to bring students up two or three grade levels in one academic year. And they have, as Brittany pointed out, she has 20 students. She will have 20 different levels of in her classroom. So try to meet the individual needs of each student and bring them up where they need to be so they have an opportunity for success that next year.
This may be an impossible question to answer succinctly here, but how do you do that? How does any one teacher manage a class of 20 kids when they're all at different levels?
I'm going to let the teachers answer that, but what we try to
that's
help,
a hard one. You're pass
a hard
on
one.
That one.
Pass that on. But really, we try to make sure that that our teachers understand each student individually, and you can meet those needs. We find ways to work with small groups, to even have students work with one another and start doing peer tutoring and working together. A lot of what we call differentiation, where we're finding multiple ways to teach in the same lesson, multiple kids.
Yeah. Helen, how have you managed that in the two short years you've been doing this?
Like Dr. Waddell said, I would say differentiation and also working with several programs that help with teaching. For example, the literacy crop that comes in and work with students who are a year or two behind when it comes to literacy.
So a specialist comes in and sort of gives you a hand here, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Does the disparity between the kids, the top-achieving kid in a classroom and the lowest-achieving kid, is that intimidating at times? Is that daunting to try to manage kids at such completely different levels?
Sometimes it is. It's not just challenging to me, it's challenging to the students as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes they sit back and they realize that, oh, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing in second grade at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it difficult for them to even open up and be willing to take on challenges to help them to the next level.
They recognize they're behind, you're
yes.
saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that can be, they get probably, they're embarrassed at times.
Yes, it definitely affects their social, emotional interactions with other students in the classroom.
And you can begin to see that those distinctions even by the third grade here, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, Brittany, you're teaching second grade. Is it your sense that there's also, can you tell the top achieving kids from lower achieving kids even in the second grade?
Absolutely.
Is there a gradation there, a set of distinctions? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Last year I had three students who were reading at a third grade level at first grade mid-year. And so we were putting interventions in place for them to keep them going at the rate that they were. While also
we're slowing
having...
down. Hey, come on. You're going too fast. Yeah.
Not at all. We want them to keep succeeding, of course. But then we also use their strengths to help the other students who were lacking. And they needed that peer support in order to encourage them. So we would have those three students helping the other students, read with them, helping them break down strategies. Because sometimes peer-to-peer, they're able to communicate things teacher-to-peer. I'm not able to put in student-friendly terms for them, or I can't think of a different way to say it. So then I'd call in one of them.
Yeah. And that peer, are students open to that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that comes with building a strong classroom community to where your students respect each other. They respect their differences, and they also want to help each other because they understand that as a class, we all have to succeed. And that's going to take place whenever we support each other.
Do kids even in first and second grade, are they embarrassed when they get behind, or are they too young?
I have some students who would be afraid to share answers in class at the start of the year, but once they realized that the only type of feedback they get would be positive, and if I had any other corrections to make, I would do that in private, then they'd be fine. So yeah. I think that it just depends on how you interact with those students and like talk to them about those deficits that they may have.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about a program. I was going to say it's a new program, but it's not so new anymore. It's a program that is the Institute of Urban Education at UMKC that teaches young people how to teach in urban classrooms in the metropolitan area. You know, I was wondering, as you approach this year, can you already spot students, Helen, where as the year goes along, you get to know their families a little bit, you get to know their parents, and can you already spot kids that you're thinking to yourself, you know, this girl or boy is going to struggle in the years to come because they're not getting the support they need at home to help them succeed?
I would say yes and no at the same time, because if you have 26 buddies in the classroom, it's definitely difficult to build relationships within the first 2-3 weeks and figure out who all might be needing the help.
As the year goes along, can you begin to spot the kids that you begin to wonder about what their futures are going to be like?
Yes. Yeah. As the school year goes by, yes, you begin to spot them. And once they are spotted, I guess there's an immediate support intervention in place for them. One thing that my school does is we have in place a student success team, and on the team we have...
Student success team, right.
Yes, and on the team we have teachers from various grade levels with mindfulness coach. So if it's something that has to do with an emotional situation, that mindfulness coach would be able to take it from there. Mm-hmm. But then if it's basically academics, then all the teachers on the success team would have to juggle and figure out what specifically the student needs to be able to be successful.
And how do those interventions take place? Are they after school meetings with the student and maybe a mom or dad, or how does that happen?
So the initial success team is brought together by the teacher, and then the parent is invited. And then once the parent is invited, the student is invited as well, so that the student is able to communicate what he or she has as strengths and what he or she thinks are his or her weaknesses, so that we can hear the student articulate it and then take it and use it.
Yeah. How successful are these intervention programs?
They are very successful. Last year, I had one student who came to my class not reading at all. That was second grade. By the end of the school year, he had started reading, and hopefully he keeps reading.
That's got to be a good feeling.
It is.
Yeah. Do you have other success stories that you can point to, even in your short time?
Yes. I had a student who had a huge emotional problem. He would scream and yell in the hallways. I had plans in place for him, so we taught him strategies as to how to deal with big moments. And by the end of the year, I would just walk down the hallway and get compliments as to, oh, we've not heard about this student, or, oh, it's been a while. So, yeah, that's a big success.
How did you help? It's a him?
Yes.
How did you help him? Tell me a little more about how you work with that kid.
So one of the things that I had was a regular communication with that student's parent, text messages, emails, phone calls, and also inviting the parent to come in on a regular basis.
And did they?
Yes, to visit on some days just to have lunch with him. And just to show that he is present in the student's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those kinds of steps began to work.
Yes.
Yeah. Jennifer?
Well, one of the reasons that the IUE began is the question that you asked, particularly about how do we meet the needs of so many students that may have challenges outside
right.
of school. And the IUE was really built on the research that the teacher is more significant than any other factor in a child's life. So if we can give a student multiple years of successful and effective teachers, we can actually overcome those challenges that mm-hmm. they're bringing into the classroom. So we emphasize in our students, and you're seeing in our two teachers here today, a real responsibility that regardless of the challenges that the student may be coming with, that they, as the teacher, will find ways to meet that child's needs and help them grow.
You know, I got to just say this for our listeners. We're going to take a break here in just a moment. But Jennifer brings some of her students to one of the classes I teach at UMKC every year. And I am just routinely so impressed with them, as I am with you two. And I hope our listeners are as well, because your commitment and your devotion and clearly where your heads are with all this is just so impressive to me. It just knocks me out, and I'm so glad to have you here today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what teachers do when a student comes to class hungry in the morning or hasn't gotten a lot of sleep before. Those are the kinds of problems that might be a little more prevalent in a urban classroom than a suburban classroom. We're going to talk about that. We're going to take your phone calls, too, at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we spoke with Dr. Damon Tweedy about racial disparities in the medical community. You can find that conversation and more at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we learn about the Muslim-American experience in the age of Trump, and we'll hear my conversation with piano legend Herbie Hancock. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with two young teachers, both graduates of the UMKC Institute of Urban Education. We're visiting with Jennifer Waddell, who leads that program, first-year teacher Brittany Espinoza, and Helen Ose, who will be a third-year teacher at the Academy of Integrated Arts Charter School in Kansas City, Missouri. What can teachers do when a student comes to class hungry in the morning, or when a student hasn't gotten a lot of sleep the night before because of whatever is disrupting the home environment? Has the battle already been lost, Brittany, in your view, or how do you size up situations like that?
Well, when students come to school without food, when they come to school hungry, when they come to school sleepy, that learning is already going to be impeded.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to learn until you meet that need. And so what I would generally do is I'd have snacks in the classroom. So that way I'd do like a mid-morning snack. Okay, you didn't get breakfast, so let me give you a snack now, 8:30, because you came in late.
How do you know if they haven't had breakfast?
My kids would just tell me.
Oh, they will.
You can just directly ask during morning meetings. A lot of teachers do that. Do you have clean clothes on? Did you eat breakfast? Questions like that. And if they haven't, then they'll let you know.
Are kids embarrassed about that, even in the first grade, second grade?
Not in my experience, but it also, like I referred to before, that strong classroom community to where, like, we know it's a safe place and the kids feel safe with me and with each other. And then whenever they come to school tired, I mean, if they fall asleep, they fall asleep, and then you catch them up on what they missed because, like I said, they aren't going to be able to learn. But I try to keep them awake as much as I can, just do more engaging activities to keep them awake.
Yeah. So this notion of building a strong community in the classroom is an interesting idea to me. You were saying in our first half, what it takes a few weeks to pull that off,
and it does.
How do you do it? How do you create that community?
You just have to show kids that you're there for them. Additionally, you have to show the parents that you're there for them as well, that the whole family unit is important to you, that you care about their well-being and you want their child to succeed because parents send you the best that they have.
Right.
And so you can't go into it with a deficit mindset. So you just have to let the parents know that you're there for them, the child, let them know that you care for them. And so that can be shown in your body language, in the way that you interact with that student. It can be asking them how they are, checking in with them multiple times a day just to see where they're at emotionally.
Mm-hmm. And this building this community takes, what, a month or two at the start of the year?
Yes, absolutely. And then it's something that you reinforce throughout the rest of the year. It's not something that once it's set, it stays in place. You have to continually show these students that you're there for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, Helen, again, you teach third grade. How do you manage this idea of kids being hungry or kids being sleepy when they come to school?
Yes, whenever kids come to school and they're hungry or sleepy, I usually have snacks in the classroom, and I would provide them with breakfast if they let me know that they are hungry. And sometimes I do approach them to know if they ate breakfast before coming in or not. With regards to students sleeping in the classroom, sometimes they just need that time to sleep. So you
let them sleep.
Yes, I would. But then
A teacher always used to bang the table and wake you up and embarrass the heck out of a kid.
It also goes back to knowing your students and the class community that you set or have in place. If you know the student and you know that based on the student's background, they might need that rest for this amount of time, looking for patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Then when the student needs it, you just have to let the student get it. But then, if it's just something that is just for, I'm just going to sleep to miss work, then once again, you have to make sure that you let the student know that this is not what is going to be allowed in the classroom.
Hmm.
So if students come in and they need the rest, yes, I do allow them to take the rest, but then find out another means of getting to them with their academics as well.
Yeah. Jennifer, one common issue that you hear about, too, are parents who may not be engaged very much in their kids' educations. I'm wondering what you advise your teachers about how to deal with that whole idea.
We actually have a course specifically designated to how to work responsibly with families.
Really?
Oftentimes, what we find in the urban core is that our families themselves were underserved. And so they don't have a positive perception of schools or of teachers. And so it's building that relationship, as Brittany talked about, making sure parents know you genuinely care about their family, that you are and their student, that you see their student as a strength, that you have high expectations for students. You asked me earlier about some of the challenges. And one of those things that happens in urban schools is teachers often will hold lower expectations for students. And so mm-hmm. what we're seeing in our successful schools in Kansas City and with our graduates of our program, they have high expectations for students despite. So they're not making excuses. They're not using sleeplessness or hunger or parents not involved as an excuse to not hold students accountable or mm-hmm. to high expectations, but they find ways to meet those needs and then still have high expectations for students.
Brittany.
Additionally, you have to understand the cultures that are represented in your classroom. So there are some cultures who believe that it's respectful to stay out of your way as the teacher. They believe that when they send their student to you, that you are the best possible thing for them in that moment. And so they try to stay out of your way. So that way, they're not impeding the education that's taking place. So like they trust you completely with their student. And so you have to understand there are some cultures that have that belief. So you have to communicate to them. I completely support you being in my classroom. You're welcome at any point to contact me. And then also with working parents, you have to kind of arrange your schedule to meet them. Okay, so if they don't get off work until 10 o'clock, can we have a conversation on the phone at 10:15 about your child's success or things that we need to discuss in order to get them on that pathway?
You're talking about 10 o'clock at night.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's where you got to be if that's where you have to meet your parents then.
Uh-huh. And so I had to do things like that last year or have conversations at 7:15 in the morning. But it's just letting your parents know that you're there for them as well as for their child.
So translating all this means your workday can be kind of long sometimes.
It can, yes.
Yeah, Helen?
And meeting the parents at where they are sometimes looks like having home visits. So sometimes some of the parents might not have the means to get to the school for meetings or to be able to communicate with you. But you being the teacher, on the other hand, have a car and you can drive. So definitely talk to the student, have a letter sent home, let parents know that you might be coming in so that they prepare meeting you in their home or somewhere else.
Jennifer, how long has the Institute been around?
We started our first class as freshmen in the fall of 2005. So this fall we'll be entering our 13th cohort.
Wow.
And our first set of graduates are entering their ninth year of teaching.
How many students have graduated from the program over the years?
We have over 80 graduates, and of those, over 70 are still teaching in the Kansas City area.
So your retention rate is pretty high.
Yes, our five-year retention rate is over 90%. We look at the That's
extraordinary compared to kids who aren't through the Institute,
right?
Yeah,
in urban schools, the attrition rate across the country is a little less than 50%. And so we're very proud of that. We look at up to the fifth year because that's kind of the marker for success. And we know if we can get our teachers successful through the fifth year, more likely they're going to be fully vested in that community and stay for the long term.
So 5 years is the magic target you're reaching for here. Yeah.
Well, we'd like it to be for their entire career. But yes, 5 years, the marker that we can say this, that we really have met success.
And how does it work that the students who enroll in the program, do they agree then to stick around the metro area for so long? Tell us about that.
Yes, it's a scholarship-based program. And so we select students that have the characteristics that you're seeing in both Brittany and Helen that are really committed to being urban teachers, to doing what it takes to meet the needs of their students. And then we provide them scholarships, a minimum of $5,000 a year. They can be upwards of $10,000 depending on our donors at that time and the wishes of some of our funders. But in exchange for that scholarship, they agree to teach a minimum of 4 years in one of our partner school districts in the Kansas City area.
So it's a four-year deal. Are there other institutes for urban education around the country?
Over the last several years, the focus on urban education has become more paramount. I mean, so we are seeing more programs, not necessarily with the same name, but programs that are really focused on how do we partner with school districts, because that's one of the successes of our program. So our students are out in schools from their freshman year multiple times a week and really getting to know the lives of teachers and of their students. And so there's many programs around the country that are starting to really partner more with school districts and build upon the community resources as well.
You know, Jennifer, you described your students as very passionate about teaching in the urban schools, and you've said that many of them have had this ambition since their childhoods. Tell us about that dream. I mean, why do students dream of working in urban schools as opposed to somewhere else?
I think that there's many different factors. We often see either students who they themselves are from urban areas and they had a positive experience in schools and saw the difference a teacher made. We also have students that come in that maybe had a negative experience and they want to change that for students that are from urban areas. We also have some of our students are not from urban areas, but they may have come from more well-served educational systems and they notice those inequities and they want to be part of trying to provide access and opportunity to students that, through no fault of their own, may not be receiving it.
So Brittany, when do classes begin?
Tomorrow. I get all 20 tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
And then they get 2 days off and then back full force Monday.
So why do you do it that way?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I think it's up to the district, but I think the kids will be happy to get 1 day in and then get 2 days to sleep in and then come back on Monday.
Sort of get some geared up here.
Yeah. Exactly.
Helen, when do you start?
Next week, Tuesday.
Yeah. Are you ready?
Yes, I am very ready. Yeah. Still trying to organize my classroom, but prepared.
How do you organize your classroom?
Well, I think of supplies. I think of dynamics. I think of literacy, math, and the various subject areas being infused in the classroom all at once so that there are diverse ways of meeting students' needs.
Brittany, when your second graders arrive tomorrow and you get them going at William Allen White Elementary in Kansas City, Kansas, what are you going to do what's the first thing you're going to do? What happens tomorrow morning?
The first thing.
And can I come?
Yes, absolutely. We did get a new playground. So around 9 o'clock tomorrow, we're going to be out on our new playground just to kind of christen it, play on it, I'm sure, and have our first morning meeting there. And that'll be the whole school. And so whenever they initially come in, greet the teacher, oh, I'm excited you're here.
Yeah.
And then they'll drop off their supplies. And then once we come back from the playground after that first initial meeting, we're going to get into our community builders.
And what's that?
So we're going to do a puzzle piece activity where I'll cut a piece of paper in half in a like unique pattern. So then they'll decorate it to represent their interest. They'll write their name on it as well. And then at the end of the activity, they'll find the other person who has their matching puzzle piece because they'll all be cut differently. And find that person, describe themselves to that other person, and just to get them familiar with each other. Because I'm sure that they've all had summer away from each other. They kind of want to get to know everybody again. And then they'll start describing what they're looking for in a teacher, which would be me, qualities that they want me to possess throughout the year, qualities they expect from each other, and then routines and procedures.
So what kinds of things do you think they'll say to you about what they expect from you at the second grade level we're talking about here?
I'm sure there'll be some silly ones where they say that they want to have recess all day, or they want me to like feed them five times a day. They want pretzels all day. But more seriously, I'm sure that they'll say they want somebody who's kind, who's willing to listen to them when they feel like they have an argument they need to present whenever I've corrected them. And they feel like, well, I don't feel like that was very just, because I have one student in mind and I'm sure he's going to grow up and be an attorney, which because he absolutely loves to defend himself, which he should. He should love to argue and feel like he should bring his side of the argument to the table. So hopefully they see those qualities in me that they have described throughout the year. So,
Helen, as you begin your third you deal with your third grade class next week when they start, what's day one going to look like?
Well, day one is going to look like welcoming students, so I am definitely going to be at the door greeting, giving handshakes, high fives, whatever it is they need to be able to feel comfortable entering the classroom. And then from there, we would have our morning meeting and the structure to morning meeting and just figuring out the whole school. We would have a school tour so that students know where what class is at and even where the bathrooms are at, because I'm still going to be getting some new students added to my previous students.
Now, this is your third year you're starting here. Are you going to be nervous on day one?
Every year it's nervous. just like students are anticipating, how is my teacher going to be like? What is my teacher going to be doing? Teachers are also anticipating, who is my student and what are they going to bring to the table? So every year starts off very nervous.
You don't sleep real well the night before.
No, not at all.
Brittany, you start tomorrow. Are you nervous?
I'm more excited than I am nervous, but I'm
sure. You seem like you're excited, yeah.
I'm sure once the parents start like working their way out of the room and then I'm the only adult in the classroom, I'll be like, oh man, this like this is all me.
This is all you now,
yeah,
right?
Mostly excitement.
Yeah. Let me go to a phone call here. Klaus from Platte City. Klaus, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I just want to add to the conversation with the following comment. I've taught for over 30 years in two countries, also in the inner cities here. And my observation, and I trained teachers for a long time, so I had access to many different classrooms. My observations are that if you don't push children for success, but instead emphasize the intrinsic value of knowledge and understanding, they will be a lot more successful than if they're being held to the importance of getting high grades. In other words, if the topic is interesting, leads them into that, and the classroom is a learning environment where they have very interesting clues and stimulation, then this is much more important than telling them from early on that they should succeed.
All right, Klaus. Good advice. I appreciate getting it as our good teachers here launch into their first days and the days to come. I want to thank you both for coming in, and by all means, good luck this year. Good luck to you, your first year out. Helen, so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Helen Osei, again, she'll be teaching at the Integrated Arts Charter School in Kansas City, Missouri, and Brittany Espinosa will be teaching second grade at William Allen White Elementary in KCK. Jennifer Waddell leads the Institute of Urban Education at UMKC. Again, thank you all very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Like a rebel's lullaby.
KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is in the house. We're going to talk about good stuff to do on the weekend ahead. And welcome back. How are you?
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
You betcha.
Green Day.
Woo. Yeah. The kids like Green Day. I think their parents like Green Day.
Yeah.
I'd go so far as to say that the grandparents like Green Day. That's going...
Sure.
I'm kind of walking the plank there.
How can you not?
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Getting Green Day on the show?
Absolutely.
Someday, some way?
That'd be
instead
great.
Instead
yeah.
of them, today it's me and you talking about, I mean, woo, you know, your goosebumps get goosebumps when you
They've
rock out to these
a while,
guys.
Haven't they?
1986.
Is that right?
Is that right?
The time has gone by.
Yeah. It sure has. Green Day, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Power Trio.
Wow.
Plus their touring guitarist, so they do get a little help on the road. They'll do their frenetic, poetic, punk rock thing. Hold on to your attitude. 7 o'clock, Friday night, Sprint Center. Mm. What's your favorite power trio?
Yeah.
Let's run down just a couple.
Please, help
Something
me.
Might spring into your head. Well, yeah. there's Cream.
Okay.
Clapton led Cream, yeah. late 60s, right? Do you recall, you know, sometimes it's easy to forget, Jimi Hendrix just seems
That's
like...
That's right.
That was a power trio.
That's right.
That
yeah,
was
absolutely.
Just
Love
guitar,
Jimi Hendrix.
Bass, and drums. Green Day plus a tour guitarist. Oh, how about The Who? Now, The Who...
They were four.
They were four, but Daltrey was not a player.
That's right.
So one could argue they were kind of different. Usually those quartets that emerged in the 60s, they were like everybody was singing
everybody
and playing.
Everybody was playing, right.
And I think they might have given Roger Daltrey a maracas or something to shake and make him feel
right.
better. But anyway, you're going to get it. You're going to get it good when Green Day does its thing Friday night at the Sprint Center. Probably easily, I'd say, their most... famous effort was American Idiot.
Right.
It won a Grammy for Best Rock Album in 2004, and perhaps just as famously, if not more so, it led to the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical, American Idiot. And as far as what American Idiot's about, well, I think if you know, then you do know, and if you don't know, you'll find out if you go see.
Whatever that means.
It means idiots in America led by the idiot-in-chief. That's what they think.
Let's talk about Herbie, the
like
great
it.
Herbie Hancock.
I like it when you look at me puzzled and say, whatever that means.
Yes.
It really, I'm going to restore my laser focus now. Okay, Herbie Hancock. Yeah, laser focus and me, those things go together.
Yes.
Okay, jazz, funk, rock, fusion master.
From a legend, absolutely.
Oh, I guess you've already spilled the beans to listeners. You are chatting with Herbie tomorrow.
Tomorrow, and we talked to him a few days ago, and we'll have that interview on tomorrow. And
well, then this is a, go ahead.
Well, he talks about his time with Miles Davis. And it's,
oh, yeah.
it's like love. That's where I love life.
You're
that's a great
completely
place.
Insane jazz aficionado.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, Herbie, we'll just give a little trailer, a little tease here for the big talk tomorrow on the show. But Herbie will be indeed performing at 7:30 Saturday night. Tickets still available at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. I'll tread lightly, but let's tread. Yes, Miles Davis Quintet, 1960s. He and Miles were part of that forward-looking fusion thing. New sounds, new ways, new audiences, right?
Right.
And then actually in 1983 came this little ditty we're listening to called Rocket. This was strange to me because this was the first time I'd been watching MTV and had seen a music video that was entirely instrumental.
Wow.
And Rocket is, of course, Herbie on the keys and so on
right.
and so forth and the scratching turntables. He is the famed pianist. He is the wonderful composer. And he's the guy that will try to play Rocket, although he might not be doing it on this current tour because I'm not sure turntables are on stage, and that's hard to do without a turntable.
Be sure to see Brian's six award-winning things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. We talked about Bloodstone yesterday. That's the group here, a local group that's
yeah.
going to be performing. Bill Brownlee talked about them yesterday, and they're getting a twofer here.
Hey, here's the thing. Sometimes if you listen to the station, there's overlap, but obviously it's meaningful.
Oh, of course it is.
Overlap,
yes.
right? So Bloodstone is indeed part of the Heart of America Hot Dog Festival. That's the Negro League's Baseball Museum honoring the hot dog. because let's face it, Cracker Jack
should be honored.
Hey, look, Cracker Jack peanuts, get in line, okay? Yeah. Get behind the hot dog. That's what it's all about when you go to the baseball game, right? So, brand new location for the hot dog festival to benefit the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Instead of being right there in the heart of 18th and Vine, this year from 2 to 11 Saturday, it'll be on the Paseo Boulevard median near 18th and Vine, like between East 18th and Truman Road.
Right.
And you'll have bands like Bloodstone, which was a whole thing in the 70s here in Kansas City, as well as R&B and funk band Zap, After Seven, and others. Let me also mention another fun downtown outdoor activity is Sly's Rock the Block Celebration. That's right. Kansas City Mayor Sly James hosts that downtown party named for him with live music and family activities. That actually takes place earlier in the day on Saturday, so front load your hot dog fun from 10 to 4 Saturday in Washington Square Park with the mayor. And I will always love you. I will always love you. I will always...
You know, I've heard that song a million times, and it just stops you every time. That is just amazing.
Well, her version...
That the human voice can do what she's doing right
her
there.
Her version, her very, very, very famous version of the Dolly Parton hit. That's Whitney Houston, of course, singing the song we can't get enough of, I Will Always Love You.
Right.
And that is the singular treat, if there is a singular one to have, when you go see The Bodyguard, the musical. That's the stage musical version of the 1992 hit movie that starred Whitney and
Kevin Costner.
Right. The plot, very simply, is he's an ex-Secret Service guy protecting a famous pop singer, and they form a connection. It's on stage nightly at Starlight Theater.
Okay.
Yeah.
And finally today.
To dream the impossible dream. To fight the unbeatable foe.
It's an interesting song to talk about our next topic here. Very apropos choice here, Dr.
Well,
McTavish.
I finally came through for you there.
Yes.
Took the whole segment.
There
okay,
you go.
Kansas City Chiefs versus the San Francisco 49ers, right?
The impossible dream.
Well, they did win it a long, long time ago.
Yes, they did.
They won that Super Bowl. So, is this the NFL season that concludes with our Chiefs finally winning their second Super Bowl? I pose that question to you, Steve Kraske.
Going to be tough. Going to be tough.
It's always tough, Steve.
Yeah, it's
Come
always
on.
Tough.
When the tough gets going? No, I'm sorry.
I think they're going to be good.
When the going gets tough,
how far
the Chiefs
we're gonna
get
go?
Going.
I don't know.
All right,
yeah.
Well, we're going to wrap it up. Hopefully the Chiefs will wrap it up with a big Super Bowl trophy. But check them out Friday night, Arrowhead Stadium. They open the season against the 49ers, and I wish them the best.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Now, tomorrow's show, The Muslim Experience in Trump's America, and my interview with jazz great Herbie Hancock. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. And I know-